In order to appease the gods, the druid priests held fire rituals. Prisoners of war, criminals, the insane, animals, burned alive in baskets. By observing the way they died, the druids believed they could see omens of the future. Samhain isn't evil spirits. It isn't goblins, ghosts, or witches. It's the unconscious mind. We're all afraid of the dark inside ourselves.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 5 of the Pretty Much Geek Podcast's Halloween Horror Month. We are finally here at the very end. We started in the beginning of October. We are now at the end of it, post LA Comic Con. We've gone through comedy, classics, thriller, found footage, and now we're here all the way at the end with Slasher. And the Slasher movie that you guys picked was Halloween 2. Not the original, not the new one. No, we decided that if we're going to put something up for an option, and we decided why not just go with the road less traveled. I'm your host, Marcel Delgado, here with Alonso Castillo, as always, my co-host.
Hey, how's everybody doing?
And this past couple of weeks, it's been Halloween crazy. Not exactly just because, you know, we're in the end of October, but the new movie came out, and in general, everyone's looking back, and it's what happens generally whenever a new film or a new installment in any type of franchise, in whatever medium it may be, comes out. Since this new movie came out, everyone's going back into these old films, and everyone's trying to see, like, what were the parts that were Easter eggs or little nods here and there, or what gems were there to be had in the originals before. I've always been a huge fan of the Halloween movies. That being said, I realize that 70% of them are pretty bad. I can differentiate between what is good and what I just enjoy. It's taken me a while to learn that, as you know, in general, being my friend. Yeah. There's a lot to be said about this movie. It's a very interesting production story for this movie. It didn't really naturally come about. It was a bit of a mess. It was a lot of things going on in the background, which we'll get into later in the second half of the podcast. But we're here now. We're here to talk about it. This was your first time watching this movie, actually. Originally, I thought that you had seen this before, but apparently it wasn't.
So actually, this was my first watch through, you know, with all these horror movies, you know, whether it be Freddy Krueger or Jason or Michael Myers, there's always so many sequels to watch. And I'm sure I must have caught most of them, if not a handful of each one of those. But I have never personally sought out to go see like each individual one. So this actually being my first, I would say, official, like, you know, fully being there watch, where I was actually able to comprehend a lot of what the movie was doing, I really enjoyed it. I found it kind of just, I would say, cool how it picks up right as the other one ends. Like how one ends literally like shot for shot, just the ending of one, and then picks right up. It's as if that night has not ended. And it's like, oh snap, here we're still not, here we go again. Like, oh no, it's still going. And I love that. It was so awesome, you know?
The main tagline of this movie was more of The Night He Came Home, which was the original tagline of the 1979 one. Yeah, because this movie was not directed by John Carpenter. This was directed by Rick Rosenthal. At this point, he had just done a couple little horror movies here and there, nothing too much, a couple little shorts. And Carpenter thought, you know, since I can't do this, I'm going to have someone else do this. Funnily enough, this movie was not supposed to come out. Everyone that was mainly working on the production of this movie worked on Halloween, put their blood, sweat, tears, effort into this, and it was an indie darling, like we said it was.
Yeah.
And it made a huge amount of money. Yeah. Overnight success, lightning was caught in a bottle, and the slasher genre was born. Carpenter got a lot of opportunity after this. He wanted to do The Fog, and then later on got like approached by Universal to do The Thing, which he was also doing at this time. Irwin Yablans was the producer of the original movies and the original Halloween movies. It was said that he didn't want to do this movie. They thought that if they were to continue on from the original movie, it would sully the intent of the original one. It was supposed to be a one-shot movie. Just take it for what it is, and let's leave it alone. Let's not touch it. Let's keep our integrity from the film that we worked on. I agree with that to an extent. However, being a fan of the movie, and things being what they are and coming to,
and Hollywood being Hollywood.
Exactly. he was pushed to doing this. Carpenter decided, you know, I'll work on The Fog first. We'll agree to this, and I'll do Halloween later. He actually went with another company to do The Fog. Yablans found out about this, sued his ass, and the compromise that they made was that he would oversee production of the movie, he would work on some of the soundtrack, and that's about it. But Halloween 2 would be made, and if the ship is going to go down sinking, I'm going to find the best captain to helm the ship if I'm not going to be doing it. And came Rick Rosenthal.
personally, I would say that the first movie is definitely a lot better directed. A lot of the inventive camera work and I think just the overall direction of the movie in the first one is definitely a lot clearer. But as this one being a direct sequel to the first one and the way, like I told you, it kind of just picks up and just really, you know, like basically gets the ball and rolls with it. I think it does a really good job of still making it feel as if John Carpenter were to be directing it. And I believe you said it, it's because they kept the same cinematographer from the first one.
Dean Cundey.
Yeah. So with that, that's actually, I think, why the movie actually kind of still works really well, is because the overall feel and atmosphere that the first one created is definitely kept here. And the story itself, like, obviously has a couple things that are, you know, a little funny and maybe even laughable. But the overall direction and look of the movie is so, like, entwined with the second one as much as the first one was, that it just feels like I'm literally still watching that first movie just continued.
It's a two-parter.
And it's awesome because, as someone, like I said, that's never really seen the first one, going back watching this movie from, like, 1981 and still being really astonished at the fact that, in my opinion, they did such a good job of continuing that storyline, that feel, the feel of Halloween, the feel of the slasher. It was kind of breathtaking. I was like, wow. And it really developed a lot of the characters more. Like, Loomis was really well developed in this one because he was almost like the protagonist in this movie, I would say.
It's in the lighting. It's in the direction of it. Rosenthal decided, you know, it's like, at this point, the original had a lot of praise. Even at that time it came out, it was already, like, just known as, like, it was a household, like, hit. And a lot of this is seeing his carnage essentially just lay itself out. The first movie took place in a couple of hours, and it was just sectioned off. It was in these couple households, and it was these three teenagers that were killed, or I think it was like four. I forget exactly the actual name, the body count. But like you were saying, this is a two-parter, and it feels a lot like, and I compared it very much to like Rocky 2 and Rocky 1. You kind of have to watch them both. It's one movie. I wouldn't put it up there as much as Rocky 1 and 2, because those two are better movies. I love Halloween 2, and I love this movie, but A Carpenter's One is the superior cut. It's not even a question about it. It's just more so in the fact that at this point, sequels weren't really a thing. It was still a novelty idea to go back and continue on to it with it. And the fact that they went ahead and they did it, and it was such a more of the night he came home, it was seeing Michael's carnage unlay itself into the rest of Haddonfield. Because the first movie felt a lot more self-contained. It's just seeing more of it just slowly trickle down into the rest of the town. The police find out more. You're seeing the media find out. You're seeing more of, like, the town go to the Myers house, and they're just trashing and wrecking the place and causing havoc because everything happens. And it makes for a lot of really good reactions from certain characters. Like with seeing Brackett's character find out that Annie died. Brackett's character, for the most part, I mean, it's not a, wow, this is a Oscar-worthy performance, but there's a subtlety to seeing the causality of everything that you saw before, right before in the last movie take place, and seeing it all affect people of the town. Because for the most part, it was all about Laurie, it was all about Michael, and it was all about just those kills. And you're just watching the first one, you see these people die, but I like seeing the repercussions of a slasher movie and seeing it hit the people that are the victims of this movie, and seeing it kind of, it makes it a lot more real, I feel.
When it trickles down into all the audiences, all the people in the town, it definitely makes it feel a lot more alive. And, you know, something that I think is a lot more interesting about the second one that kind of really plays into the role of making Michael this sort of unstoppable evil force. I think it's said that in the first one, he's named as the Shape because John Carpenter envisioned him as this, like, evil force, this entity of evilness. In this one, they allude to that a lot more, and this movie is like a love letter to the fans because it definitely takes all, like, the, I would say, best and most enjoyable parts of Halloween, the original, and kind of mashes them together by, you know, keeping that tension and the kills and the look and the feel and the aesthetic and Laurie, and there's all these moving parts that were taken out of the first one and put it into this movie that really continue that feel of it. And that's why I think I enjoyed it so much, because it doesn't do anything to really offend me as being a fan of the first one. It actually, if anything, kind of amplifies all the stuff that I kind of enjoyed out of the first one.
I enjoy this movie, but there are a couple things that I feel are gone with this one. It's been a couple years since the first one came out, 79, and then this has been like 1 or 2 years since this one came out. And in order to basically keep up to date with the slasher game at this time, Carpenter thought it was key to keep up with the times. And because of that, you had to keep up with Jason, you got to keep up with Freddy, you got to keep up with those kills and the violence. And this one has a lot more gore in it. There's a lot of kills that are directly, if you see them in this one, it's so jarring to see it compared to the first one. Because I watched them back to back, and I remember you can see it's just an insanely evident jump. Everything's more implied, or it's just not seen. The gore isn't seen, whereas this one, there's puddles of blood. There's several kills here where you just kind of cringe in a just like, oh, you went that route. And the thing is about it is I love it is that it is grade A 80s slasher.
Yeah.
For the time. And it's just, this is what you see when you add a universal budget to it and you give it more of that extra layer of production. I think also for some degree, it's a little bit lost in there. I always like the theater of the mind is the better way to go about it. And I think that was what made the first one so much more effective and still stands tall and compared to this one.
I completely agree with that. I guess what I just mean more is that's attributed to John Carpenter's like masterful directing of the first one. In this one, I feel like the way they kind of like swayed that and balanced it out to equate the same level of enjoyment was by making it more gory, making it showing a lot more kills. Because like I said, this one feels like, oh, we're going to show you more of what Michael is and what he does and how he operates. I like that they did show that, but I can definitely understand how by them showing that almost takes away like the mysticism, the horrific event of the fact that, oh no, like he's coming, and the next thing you know, someone just died in the other room and you didn't even get to see it. You just know that that person is screwed and they're dead, and like there's nothing that person could have done to stop Michael from getting to them.
Yeah, for me it's more so just like it just feels like Carpenter's vision was a little bit lost in this one, and it almost feels a lot like the Peter Jackson and the Hobbit movies to me, where it's like you watch that those movies in comparison to the original Lord of the Rings trilogy, and similar situation, ships going down, sinking. However, it's not that big of a departure. There are a couple things here that which I'll get to in a bit where it's just, it becomes a little comical sometimes, and it almost feels like not as bad as, you know, Season of the Witch or Return or Curse of Michael Myers, the movies get on later on. It starts becoming a little more of a parody of the first one and how subtle it was. And you were saying something earlier when you're talking about how like he's almost like this force and stuff like that, and I always feel like that is the reason why I think Michael is the perfect evolution of the monster in horror. Very similar to Frankenstein, they in the credits Boris Karloff wasn't Frankenstein's monster, it was simply the monster. And in the original 79 film, it was Michael was known as the Shape, and I always found that to be really interesting to me. And seeing the relationship between Loomis and Michael is almost similar to Van Helsing and Dracula, or, you know, any of those, the foils that happen generally with like there being an adversary. And it's something that if it wasn't for the fact that Donald Pleasant is such a trained actor and a great thespian, it'd be lost on this movie. Like in the beginning where he runs around and just he'll say just like, you don't know what the meaning of death is. And it just runs around away with like the new electronic theme from this new movie. And I think there's a part in later on where he is running up to a cop as the cop pulls him up and he says, I shot him six times, and it's just going on and off. And I feel for Donald Pleasance a little bit because he's just doing the best of what he can right here. And the script just feels like he just has Loomis running around like a little bit of a lunatic compared to the first one, where he was also kind of crazy, but it was more of like this madness that is earned and madness that you can see from just marinating all these years, and you see that this man has had to deal with this evil, the devil's eyes, like you said in the first movie. And this one, it just feels more so just like regurgitating a lot of the same things here and there. There's one great scene later on in the movie that lands up being the best line of dialogue in the entire film, but also one of my favorite bits of dialogue in the entire series, and it's the Sam Haim monologue, in which he says that mankind isn't afraid of demons, it's not afraid of anything else on Halloween night. Man is afraid of our darkness and what's in our minds. And the way that Pleasance delivers that entire monologue equates to the reason why, and he's part of the reason what made this franchise.
He definitely is. Like Loomis, like that's what I was saying earlier, where I feel not the whole movie, but a lot of the movie really rests on his shoulders, and he kind of carries us through it. And it's really awesome to see that, because he's such a good actor that I'm like, you know, kind of really invested in what's going on with him and what's going to go on. Like, is he going to find Michael? You know, like what's going to happen with Lori? Like there's, like I said, these moving parts that kind of almost make you feel like slowly but surely the tension tension is building and the night almost never seems to stop. But I do agree, there are definitely some times where this movie kind of falls off pretty hard, and a lot of laughable moments, like the scene where I was like, where they run over a 17-year-old boy and he catches on fire, and
it's just escalated so fast.
And they're like, oh, well, yeah, we got him, I guess. And nobody really bats an eye.
I mean, police brutality being what it is, it's not unbelievable. So, you know, hey, there's that.
To me, it was just really weird to see that. And then nobody really reacts to it because they just assumed he was Michael Myers because he had a similar mask.
It's not just that they just killed some random guy. They killed Ben Tramer, which was the implied love interest of Laurie from the first movie. And that's what always something that I found interesting, especially when I watched it this time around, because this movie, it starts off with, by the Chordettes, Mr. Sandman, a classic song that everyone and their mother knows. And it's playing in the beginning, and they play it at the end. And I feel that it's in the subtext that Michael becomes Mr. Sandman. It's a nice evolution of the shape, of the evil, of just like this presence that's just ever looming, ever present, and unstoppable. And Laurie can't go to sleep. And that's why I feel it's so effective in the fact that they have this movie set in a hospital. It's in Haddonfield General. And how more terrifying can it be than being in a hospital? The fact that you have this man coming after you, and it's a nice little play on of the lyrics of Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream, make him the cutest that I've ever seen. And we kill the only one that she had a crush on, the only person that she was interested in. And instead, the universe, or the devil himself, or however you want to say it, Loomis would say it, sends Michael to him, to her.
Yep. And so this movie definitely has a lot of things going for it. A lot of the bad things that came out of this movie, whether it be some of the dialogue or some of the writing or even some of the soundtrack, it probably could be attributed to the fact that this movie was in production hell. And I think a lot of that really ties back to that, and we've seen that from time and time again from movies now where they have a promising director, you know, like Edgar Wright and Ant-Man, then next thing you know something
Josh happened. Trank with Van Forstig and various other things. It's going off of a couple of the superhero movies as the recent examples to go off of.
And so with all that, you know, I can only imagine how that this must have been way back when filmmaking must have been really difficult to do because they actually had to deal with film and not digital. So
I gotta ask you, what was your favorite kill? There's a couple of good ones in the first one as well. There are a lot of classic iconic imagery in the first one, but this one had a lot of just visceral violent deaths that felt a lot more it pleases the horror hound inside.
I would say, I mean, I really have to, because obviously the fire when the kid gets slammed by the car, because I just
that right now, yeah.
It was just hilarious. But by Michael, I think if I had to pick, it's probably when the nurse gets her face dipped into the boiling hot water.
In the therapy bath.
And she gets drowned. I'm like, okay, that was pretty rough.
Yeah, because this one's been leading up for a while, because we have our nurses, we got our EMTs, and we kind of have like this little bit of just a staff going on at the hospital, and including a head nurse, and the nurses and the EMTs are kind of like just, there's one in particular, Bud, who, I love that character. He was kind of hilarious. I kept on laughing when he had his little take on Amazing Grace. It's like the most vulgar way to like just go about it. And it's Leo Rossi as Bud. He just plays the Italian just dog, which just like this gangster type, just like very East Coast type of character, which he was almost not even cast in the movie because Deborah Hill didn't want him in the movie. He said a lot of Leo Rossi's mannerisms were very East Coast, but Rosenthal came in for him at the end of the movie and just kept on like championing him that he gets in the movie. And I was happy that he was in this movie. He had a lot of character to him, and several of these characters like had more or less and so at that. But when they finally get to that scene that you're talking about, it is one of my favorite scenes, because the amount of just violence and just terror that is in that. I don't want to be burnt alive.
Oh no.
Hell, I love turning the heat up on my whenever I'm taking a shower or whenever I love myself a good hot tub every now and then.
Yeah. But
imagine scalding water right there. No. It's just being drowning while you're just being burnt alive and seeing like the skin just fall off of her, and just Michael is also getting burnt at this time too, which just that, and that's like that's another reason why I love the kill, because it just shows how just
he doesn't care. No. Nothing. He's just an unstoppable force.
Yeah, that was one of favorite of mine. I think my second would be when the nurse, played by Anna Elisa, finds the doctor with the needle in his eye, and Michael turns up right behind her, and just you get like this quick shot with the injection into her temple, and it hits and it goes into her eye, and it's just, I don't like eye shit. I don't fuck with my eyes. I have to wear contacts, and even then, that's the fact that I wear contacts is already enough of a struggle that I had to get over. But any time that you deal with, you're messing with the eyes in horror movies, I ain't a fan of that shit. I don't like that. But that was one of those kills where I'm just like, it's effective and it's a little over the top. And it's one of those kills where, like I said, I couldn't imagine that being in the first movie. No, it's a very different beast in its own because of that.
But when you were, you know, what you were actually saying about the whole building tension, one of my favorite, I guess you would call it sequence, because it's longer than about a shot, is actually when Lori is running away through the elevator and then through the window as Michael is just coming. Like, and you know what's really funny? During that scene, it really made me think of It Follows, which I'm like, that movie must have gotten so much direct inspiration from this, of this literal unstoppable force that does not ever stop, literally, until it gets what it wants. And that's how I felt as Michael would just, he would lead her past the elevator, he would lead her down the hallway, he would lead, and you would just see him always coming. It's always there, and no matter what she did to get away, eventually it would show up. And like, it was so interesting that it reminded me of It Follows. These movies, like the first one obviously, but the second one I think, and the sequels that follow, just all these little things that continue to add to the whole like lore of what a slasher, what horror could be overall.
I mean, the creature in It Follows was just an avatar of just horror in general. I mean, I think the it being a just, you can, it can be whatever you want it to be. It's death. It's just coming for you.
Yeah.
And Michael is, like you said, like, it's the best example of that. And that's why I think Michael's the most terrifying too, because Freddy will run around and he'll like chase you in your dreams. He'll make a pun here and there. Some zombies will chase you. And
he's like evil Spider-Man.
Yeah. Something like that. But Michael walks. Michael doesn't care. He's gonna get you. There's no hope wherever he's around. That's why he's so terrifying. I've always found him to be more effective than any of the other iconic horror icons.
I did have a question for you.
What's up?
For the ending, for the boss battle that happens at the end of the movie, I was curious to see what you actually thought about that.
Oh, what was that? Like that, that nice little 2v1
Yeah, battle, the boss battle.
Lori, Loomis, and Michael.
I thought that was a little funny.
It was definitely funny because it was being dragged on so long, and the way it was directed and cut, it... I saw what they were going for. I mean, I like the fact that Lori gets a couple good shots in on Michael, and she shoots him in the eye. And you think that's going to be enough to stop him, but no.
Nope.
He just keeps swinging. And I will say, I love that scene where he just is swinging. He doesn't know where he is and or who he's swinging at, but he's just going to go and try to get Lori. And Loomis comes in, tries to help with this, and things just escalate, and it eventually becomes like this gigantic fiery mess, but Michael survives, which we get that nice image of him walking through with the fire and stuff like that, and I love that part. I love some of the shots in here. They have a lot of like great images and just this... a lot of just good shots.
Yeah, no.
That stick with you in your mind.
Yeah, like I said, I think a lot of that is attributed to the cinematographer who obviously worked on the first one, so he must have lit and worked on the set, like everything that made the movie look how it is. So, and same thing with this one, with all the camera work and all the way it looks and a lot of the way the camera really moves and transitions.
There's a lot of steady cam.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's really awesome.
This is one thing I wanted to get onto because... earlier in the movie, we had one of my favorite scenes, which was the POV scene with Michael in the beginning, where you see what happens from when he gets up. At the end of the first movie, we hear that breathing, and it's implied that he's gone somewhere. Well, now this is the first bits of actual vision that we see from him. And he's just walking around to the back of the neighborhood. And my aunt has a neighborhood around here. It's up in the Fullerton area. It's over near Malvern and stuff like that. And if you keep going up in those hills, a lot of the way that architecture of those old houses, they were from like the 50s and the 40s and so like that. And they've kind of kept up the neighborhoods around there. I think I've taken you a couple of times. And around Halloween, it gets very lit.
There's a lot of... it's awesome.
It's not... It's
literally looks like a scene out of a movie.
Shit like this would not go down, but... on the other times of the nights, and I remember when I was growing up and whenever I was seeing, when I would just have to like walk outside for some times and I would just walk around the neighborhood a little bit, or I would just come walking from school or something like that sometimes when I would go there, it would be very scary. The entire street's empty. You wouldn't see kids out. You wouldn't see adults out. Sometimes of the night, even around like 7 or 8 o'clock, it's almost like everyone was asleep or didn't exist.
Oh, yeah.
A ghost street. And it looks right out of Haddonfield. In which is why I found like the scene in the alley where he's walking around. I've walked through alleys like that. I've seen that. And there's so much lighting in the front of these houses, but when you get to those back parts of it, it's almost like you're in a different area. This is seeing people like Michael walking around. And those were the fears that I had when I was growing up, that there would be people or things walking, boogeymen, walking around.
And that actually reminds me, and I don't know if you remember this, and because we live so close, there used to be a guy when we were like, I want to say 10 or 11, there used to be a guy every Halloween that would stand right here on our street in Michael Myers mask with a knife. He used to be there every Halloween. I remember being a kid right by down our street. He would stand there and just walk back and forth, like with the knife. And
oh, we're in elementary school.
It was like probably like in fifth or sixth grade. When we were in fifth or sixth grade, and I used to go trick or treating with my mom and other people around our neighborhood. There was a dude that would stand there in a Michael Myers mask. I swear to God, like it was one of the coolest. It was terrifying because he would go out real late. Like he'd be out. I got 11 or 12, and I remember just like looking outside because we would still give out candy after, you know, like I was a kid, so maybe around like 9 o'clock I'd come home, but we'd still get our candy, and I would look down the street, and I would see this dude. I remember everybody would avoid him because it was terrifying. Like, if I have to admit, I had experienced, obviously, Halloween my entire life, but I don't think I had ever experienced such a true Halloween until you took me to that street, because I literally felt as if I walked onto a movie set where they were shooting a Halloween movie or something that was Halloween-related, because there were jack-o'-lanterns on every house. All the houses had lights on them. There was like a dude that had like these fake witches running across the trees, like pulling them and scaring kids as they ran. But it was such an awesome experience going into that, and like I just love going to that area because of exactly how it feels like you could be where Halloween took place, where Michael Myers had walked through these streets. And it's really, really awesome, you know, to feel that true connection that you had for something, obviously, in real life, because it feels so close to home, but at the same time, really kind of puts you in the mood for what these movies are.
And that's the thing. It's like Michael isn't a zombie. He's not a demon in your dreams. He's not a Promethean giant. He is just, minus some of the, obviously, taking like 6 bullets to the
chest and 2 to the eye. And
some of the, as we get on later on, the movies continue on, it's a lot of it becomes a little more just unbelievable. But just at face value of just being someone that escape from an insane asylum.
Yeah.
What's more terrifying. He is the American Nightmare, and he is, I'd say, people have always had a fascination with a serial killer, and Michael is the easiest example of why. There's this mythos behind him. Yeah. There's all of this extra layers of like, why is he the way he is? Why does he kill? This movie because originally, I mean, the way it ends and stuff like that, and it ends in a fiery death.
Which is awesome.
Both for him, and it was also considered Loomis as well. I think this was a really good way to end it.
Yeah, I think so too, honestly.
So, I mean, to me, if this was going to be how it were to just go off, and if you want to, you could just watch these two as a one and two back and forth watching of a marathon.
Yeah.
And be done with it. And it would just be a solid watch.
This is definitely an end. Like, obviously, Loomis blows up and Michael walks out, which I that first shot when he walks out the fire is so cool, because it's like, damn, he's not stopping. This force of nature will not cease, not even fire. But then obviously he collapses, and it almost kind of shows a little bit like, all right, he is still of man. Even if he is this force of nature, he is within held by this human body, I guess.
Which, even if you want to even go into it more, slight spoilers for the new 2018 movie, fire can't kill him in either one.
Yeah,
and which I like that they continue with that and they pull that in from this one.
Yeah, so it's just really awesome to see all the lineage that these two movies, but obviously really the first one, but created, and how, I don't know if this was one of the, I'd have to imagine that these this movie, these movies were the reason why we have so many sequels of so many of these horror movies, because they really did kickstart it.
And there's a ton of legacy with this movie, and it becomes a lot more legacy with the later installments in the movie, but we'll get into that in the second part of the podcast. We've now reached in the first part, and that is as good of a segue as I can go. So we'll hear a little bit from our sponsor right now in the break. Until then, we'll be back in just a moment. I've always looked forward to breaks, whether it be when I'm at work and I'm just tired and want to get off that shift, or I'm in class and I just want to go home and get my ass back to doing what I love doing, talking to you guys and making content for all of you beautiful people. And now that we've gotten to the halfway point and we've gotten to the nice juicy center of the meat of this podcast, we've now hit the break point and we've got the hookup just for you guys. Still Hungry IE is home of the notorious donut burger, Ludachuck burger, fries, drinks, and anything else you crave. Just stop by their trucks and stands in the Inland Empire, Orange County, and LA County area and let them know that you're from Pretty Much Geek, and you'll get free fries and a drink with the purchase of a notorious D&B. If you want to find out where they are exactly when you've got the munchies, you can follow them at Still Hungry IE on Instagram. Now, as much as I love doing promos, I like eating the stuff for promos. So let's get back to the podcast, and I'm going to get back to my D&B.
Michael Myers is a myth. He's the boogeyman. Ghost story to scare kids. But this boogeyman is real.
Welcome to In Hindsight, where we take a look back at films both classic and contemporary, regardless of nostalgia, but all with love. With the month of October comes the obvious, horror, a favorite genre of mine with multiple variations in it from comedy, classic, thriller, slasher, and more. This is Marcel Delgado, and today we're headed back to Haddonfield for a reunion 40 years in the making, Halloween. It's been four decades since audiences were first terrified by Michael Myers, an icon both in horror, film, and for the holiday itself. What I found intriguing about the newest sequel is that it essentially retcons 39 years of legacy in the franchise. Everything from Halloween 2 to Resurrection is no longer canon. It's a practice Hollywood has adapted to trim the fat of oversaturated franchises like Alien and Terminator. Here, it's done effectively so that we can bring it back home. There are a few pacing problems in the beginning, one or two questionable side characters, but by and large, this is the only other movie since the Carpenter classic to nail it. Jamie Lee Curtis reprises her role as Laurie Strode, who suffers PTSD from that night years ago. The authenticity in her performance here adds such nuance to others who haven't had a deal with Michael. The Shape of Evil himself here is at its strongest, as a swift, merciless, and empty avatar of horror. His kills are visceral and shot with such ferocity, it's as though this thing has been salivating for the moment. And it's here. Though not as quiet or flawless in its delivery as the classic, Halloween 2018 works as an homage to it, and in hindsight, is a welcome addition to the franchise.
Say goodbye to Michael and get over it.
In Hindsight is part of the Pretty Much Geek Network, available on YouTube, Instagram, iTunes, Podomatic, and all social media. You know, it was one thing that we forgot to talk about, and that is the biggest plot twist in this movie. The whole revelation of this was that Laurie Strode is Michael Myers' sister.
Which is kind of like, you know, like...
Which for me, I mean, that's... I already knew this was going to be a thing. I remember I've known that since I was younger. I was always a... But I remember at the time, this was like a big revelation. And for me... It was right here. It's just done lazily. I feel it's just thrown in halfway through the movie. They do it through a flashback through like where it's yeah. just and it just was like I told you you're not I'm not your mother and I'm just like oh god like the right the way that the dialogue is done and just like the imagery is kind of just I see what they were trying to go for and I remember even when like the nurse from the first movie, which was funny, they brought her back with a little cameo talking to Loomis and saying they should have shown you her file. And it's like, really? This guy is so obsessed with it, and it's a little as hard to believe that, and it's just kind of like the writing is very transparent, and that it's, here we're throwing in something. However, narratively, I think it is a brilliant and organic choice. It should have been there in the beginning.
Yeah, because it definitely makes it understandable why he is so attracted at chasing her down and killing her. You know, there's what is it? Because it almost seems like he's obsessed with her, and it's like, why? But now it makes sense. It's like, oh, it's his sister. So
right.
There's at least some sort of connection there that she is there for, or she is drawn to him, and he is drawn to her, to be honest.
Yeah. Like Michael, like Loomis says at one point, he's coming back years later to finish the job. He killed the first sister in the 60s, and now he's killing her, finishing the job. And the thing is, it works effectively in Rob Zombie's movie, but that's because it was already done. This movie already had it already, and we now get it from the very get-go. And it's already established in the origin that Laurie Strode is a sister. We're not hiding it. There's no revelation about it. And it makes it more of this just generational bit, and I like that. It adds a lot more sense to it instead of it being this just, he just wants to kill her. I can see the argument being made that makes it more horrifying because there is no logic here. It is just chaos, and I respect that argument. I know that it exists, and that there are
interesting.
There's been a few people who I've heard that they think that the sister angle is a little bit contrived.
Really? Well, because I feel like if it was chaos, I feel like he would just have moved on from Lori. You know what I mean? Because it wouldn't. Because I feel like trying to continue to chase her is some sort of order. You know what I mean? Because he's like always going after her, and even in the new one, the 2018 one, he's still going after her. So it's like I feel like that involves a little bit of thought if it's that angle. You know what I mean? Like, because it's like, why always her?
I see the argument. It's still one of those things where I still agree with this. So I think it's the better route to pick for. And I thought if you're gonna go for a twist, even though it wasn't executed as well as it could be, or as clean as it could be, I appreciate the effort into it, and I like the addition to the mythos that even though it was retconned, I appreciate
with
it
the new 23
at the point one. Yeah, we don't see much from Laurie in the franchise until later in H2O, which is also directed by Rick Rosenthal, which, funny enough.
Yeah.
I remember that was a favorite, that's one of your favorite movies in the franchise.
And that's funny that I watched this one, and this one I actually also really enjoyed, and H2O, at least as far as I knew at the time from watching it when I was a kid, was my favorite one also.
I bought the Scream Factory 10 disc, or I forgot how many movies there are discs they threw in there, Blu-ray box set, which is one of my favorite purchases. Even though I shouldn't have made that purchase, it is a purchase that I am very proud of, and I'm glad whenever I see it on there. But I remember as I kept on going through that first initial marathon when I was watching them all, H2O was one. It was the one that felt like they had the most care given to it, which with this one too, it has the same feel with it, and that's why I'm glad that Rick Rosenthal was involved in that too. However, like we were saying earlier, and we were alluding to, there was a lot of cooks in the kitchen for this movie, and whether it be Mustafa Akkad, who was producing the movie.
Those damn producers always trying to get their word in, always trying to say what way to do, and they're like, well, I have the money, so therefore, I know best. And it's like, ugh. And that's not true. Whether you hear it from interviews where directors talk about producers wanting one thing or another, it's never always the right choice to listen to one specific person.
And whether it was Mustafa Akkad or John Carpenter or Deborah Hill, and there was Universal, and there was just so many different hands at play here that there was a lot of different things going on. Originally, John Carpenter and Deborah Hill were not a fan of Rosenthal's director's cut. So what they did is they had a bunch of reshoots eventually being made. A couple things here that made sense. Like I remember there was in the original cut, there was no reasoning given where Michael knew where Laurie was. He just went to her. Which is why they added the scene where he bumps into the kid with the boombox, because the boombox has had the radio on and it was playing the news bulletin of where Laurie was being. If Michael's still out and he hasn't been caught, then I don't understand why you would release that. But whatever, it's small town. Mistakes being made, but things like that.
News travels fast.
Yeah, a lot more added violence and a lot more just gratuitous things added to it. And that also led to the TV cut. That also led to the television cut, which was made for broadcasting, and it was lost for a while. Then AMC started airing it, I think around like 10, 15 years ago. And you can find it comes in the Blu-ray as a second disc that you can, they released it for the home video. And there's a lot of differences. There's the two different cuts have very different styles. It's the same story, a couple, but there's a few key differences. Now, do you know which one that you watched?
I watched the theatrical because I watched the more gratuitous scenes.
Yeah, I watched both of them. I sat through both of them. But it was more of a chore at the second time I was watching it, but...
Super fan.
PMG, we make a lot of sacrifices.
We go above and beyond.
There we go. The TV cut has a lot more of the deleted scenes as an alternate ending, but generally speaking, it's a lot more tame. Less of the violence is, more of the violence is implied. We see a lot more character development from the staff of the hospital. But the thing is, it's a lot more slower paced. On top of that, there are moments where you can clearly see that they're actually just straight up dubbing over, cursing, and there's a couple things here and there. And it's not even done in a very just like seamless way. It's just done very just like straight.
Lazily.
Yeah. And it just, there are some aspects of it which I do appreciate. We see the relationship between Jimmy, the EMT that's in this movie and is constantly like has some sort of just, is just connected to Lori. He feels bad for her and he sees her as the victim through all this, and it's tied to her, and it was a little thing that they were throwing in there as a little side plot, and I wasn't really feeling it much in the theatrical cut. I understood a little bit of it, but it kind of just felt like just thrown in there and kind of forced. And the TV cut, we get more of a understanding of it, and there's more, a couple scenes here and there that were, implies it more, and it just makes for more of an understanding of that. You see more of Nurse Alves being more of a caring nurse and a boss that actually cares about her staff. Not to say that she doesn't care about her staff in the theatrical cut, but she comes off more cold in the theatrical cut, where that's not really the case in the TV cut.
Yeah, which I think obviously was cut out for time, but it's probably because they were side characters, so they just felt it didn't really add to the overarching plot or narrative. But it is a shame because it's like we missed out on so much character development, which would have made us care about the characters and what happens to them in the movie. So that's kind of always, I feel like, the balancing act that studios and obviously directors and everybody else who's involved kind of have to do, where they got to make the best movie they have with the limited time that they got. So
yeah, there's also an alternate ending where they show off Jimmy, because in the movie Jimmy almost dies twice. If he actually dies in the end of the movie, it's implied, but we don't exactly know. At the end of the alternate ending, though, we see that Lori's getting into the ambulance. She's going to be headed off and moving to a safer place. Right in the background, a body jumps up and we find out that it's Jimmy, and they hold hands. They say that they made it together, and that's, it ends the same way with the Chordette's Mr. Sandman ending it, which I don't really like it. If it was a lot more forced, it's less
more Hollywood ended, like,
it's unnecessary, I think, and it moves the focus away from Lori and it just brings him into it. And it's one of those things where I just feel like the original ending is more haunting. We get like the thing of her just wondering, is he still alive or did he, I mean, he, I saw this dude take fucking 7 shots
to the face.
Or even, yeah, he took 7 shots in the first movie, but it was 6 shots in this one. There was a little bit of an editing error in this one when they re-showed that. But yeah, no, he's an unstoppable killing force. And then that haunting image of him just burning, the mask burning. I prefer the actual cut, if I were to go for it.
Yeah. Two.
And there should be a, you know, hopefully somewhere there on the internet, there is a version of this movie where it has the best scenes from the TV cut that were in there, inserted in there, and it has somewhat more of the faster pacing of the theatrical. But until then, I would so honestly recommend just watching the theatrical cut.
You're gonna enjoy it a lot more than you would with the TV cut. Plus, obviously, the dubbing and getting rid of a lot of the gore kind of takes away, I feel like, the little fire flare that this movie tries to add. It's like you're almost missing out, I guess, on what this movie was probably going for.
Well, I gotta ask you a question. What did you think about the soundtrack for this one?
I actually enjoyed it. I don't know if it was so much the soundtrack or if it was the audio mixing itself, because I think a lot of the music came in or started up at really good times that I think added to the scenes and didn't really take away. As you were talking about earlier, the like synthy Halloween theme. Once you pointed it out, I did kind of realize how kind of funny it sounds. But at first, I honestly just thought it was because it was a later movie. They just used like cleaner audio equipment, and that's how it was supposed to sound.
They brought in another guy to come in and work with Carpenter on the score. I think he was working on the... He did some of the score for Star Trek II, if I'm correct. can't really think of the top of my head right now. The soundtrack for this one has almost like a bit of a, I said this, it felt like a parody of the original movie. Not that bad, because it's still, I still think it's effective as hell, especially more so later on the movie, but which I love the bit with the pumpkin and the skull slowly forming in, and you start, as you keep zooming into it, you get that nice image of the pumpkin, which is now iconic. I feel like it's not as effective as that original score. It's just too high-pitched, it's erratic, and it just doesn't have that same effect to me. It's almost like that haunting vibes that the original one had is just missing, and it's a lot more of a faster pace, which is could be a nice metaphor for how this movie was compared to the first one. But not so much, because I did still enjoy this movie majority than more than I'm like than that metaphor is leading on.
In the sense that this movie does feel like a continuation of the same movie, of the first one, it does feel a lot faster, I guess you would say, and I think it was that rush attitude of like, all right, we know what you're here for. You're here to see Michael do what he does, and let's just get to it. And maybe that's why the soundtrack was also sounded like that faster pace, kind of rush thrill to it, which really does lose that thriller horror element in the first one. It almost kind of reminds me of like the direction, obviously much better directed, but Alien versus Aliens, where, you know, the second one's a lot faster action pace, and it's like still sort of like the first one, but it does its own thing. And this one too, like it feels sort of like the first one, but it's trying to rush into doing its other things, like more gore and being a lot more faster paced with the kills and all these other elements that they try to add.
Yeah, there's a couple of mistakes here and here and there. Acting is a little isn't the best at sometimes. Dialogue is a little campy, and I generally feel there is a sense of that. Just it is what it is. I can complain about it as much as I can, but I enjoy it more than anything. And this movie has a cult status now because of that. It took about like 20 or 30 years after it released, but it's now here, and it's considered one of the best, if not the best sequel in the franchise up until now. But in the multiverse, in a world where this is the only sequel that we got, I think that this is a good way to end it off of. And yeah, I think it's a really good follow-up that both honors the original and adds a couple little things here and there and adds a couple more for people to have and enjoy. And as we're now at the end of the podcast, we are now at the end of another Halloween horror month. We're done with it. We get 5 a year, and this is the 5th one. We're done with this now. Get rid of all the Blu-rays. Let's just take down all the fucking pumpkin shit that we got, and it's time for November, which...
No more pumpkin spice.
No more pumpkin spice. I feel that on a level that you don't... Me and Jose will feel that on a level that you don't even have to understand and deal with that shit. The amount of pumpkin spice and pumpkin chai that I have to keep serving people, I'm tired of it. The November 1st, first things they're going to be doing is giving nothing but just peppermint drinks all the time.
Yep.
God.
Here comes the candy canes.
Oh, yeah.
Here come the candy canes, here comes the podcast, and here comes the outlet. If this is your first podcast with us, welcome. Either way, thank you. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook, where we post daily about news, opinions, memes, and more from movies, gaming, comics. Enough said. Also, did you know we're on the radio? We have a weekly series on 90.1 FM KBPK in Hindsight, where I talk about movies without nostalgia, but all with love. And this week we just finished up the horror month, but November is going to be all about Rocky. If that sounds up your alley, head to 90.1 FM KBPK if you're in the Orange County area, or 90.1 KBPK on the TuneIn app for everywhere else. If you like this podcast, let us know by leaving a like and subscribing to us on whichever platform you're on. YouTube, iTunes, Podomatic, we've got them all. And leave comments. It seems like a small thing, but it goes a long way seeing the community be active. I always enjoy doing Horror Month. It gives me a chance to watch some movies I've never seen and some I love. And doing it with my friends and seeing the hype listeners have over it just adds to the month for me. However, next week's show is going to be all about LA Comic Con. Alonzo, Jose, Parker, and me went to the con as press, so we'll talk about that. Because it was fun, but it was also interesting. With all that finally done, Alonzo, thank you for joining me.
Of course.
And until next week, if it's important, newsworthy, and pretty much geek, we'll have it covered all under our radar. Happy Halloween, everyone.
And with that being said, we are finally here at the end of another Halloween horror month. And as the leaves... I'm not saying that.
fall, as the orange comes in. Why not hit me with that haiku, right?
Oh, shit.
Fuck.
as the leaves turn orange and the summer approaches. It's like, oh my god. We hear Dr. Seuss and the Grinch coming. It's like, oh shit, alright, we're really going ham.